Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been 9 days since the massive toxic mine spill released 3 million gallons of toxic water into the Animas River in Colorado. That equals about 60,000 full bathtubs. The water contained extremely high levels of lead, arsenic, cadmium, and mercury. On August 5th, EPA workers were supposed to pump out and treat contaminated water at the defunct Gold King mine in southern Colorado. When workers entered the mine, a leak sprung and the tainted water gushed into the nearby Animas River. It flowed downstream for dozens of miles, crossing state lines in Utah and New Mexico. Yesterday, Colorado Governor John Hinkenlooper drank a bottle of water from the river after adding iodine tablets to it to show that the water is safe to drink. But the Navajo Nation has declared a state of emergency. In a CNN op-ed, Earthworks Policy Director Lauren Pagel writes that what's missing from the media coverage is information about the lack of strong regulations that allow these disasters to happen. Earthworks estimates that 500,000 mines in the U.S. need to be cleaned up. The price tag, $50 billion. Joining us to talk about coverage is Jonathan Thompson. He's senior editor of High Country News, a nonprofit media organization. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. We are also joined by Michael Stoll, executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit, non-commercial news organization that publishes a website and quarterly newspaper. In the latest issue, Michael Stoll, Kevin Stark, and Winifred Bird published an in-depth investigation about the $21 billion tech-driven building boom in flood-prone areas near Bay Area shorelines. They report that builders plan to invest more than $21 billion in offices and homes in flood-prone areas where waters could climb 8 feet above today's high tide by the end of this century. Land use records reveal that the building boom, fueled by a white-hot tech economy, is moving too fast for regulators to keep pace. And Michael Stoll joins me in studio. Hi, Michael. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Michael Stoll with San Francisco Public Press, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Oh, I've been fascinated and kind of inspired by the work that the San Francisco Examiner has been doing, tracking on a daily basis the corruption scandal in and around City Hall. You know, we've seen this story bubbling up for the last year plus after allegations came through the courts that the FBI had been taping a lot of politicians, including Leland Yee and Keith Jackson, also connected to some alleged mobsters in and around Chinatown. These stories have now been reaching up through City Hall to Mayor Ed Lee. There are some actually fairly credible accounts in some of these filings that say that Ed Lee's campaign or people associated with Ed Lee's campaign are illegally bundling campaign contributions, $10,000 at $500 chunks. And you know, so far, the reaction from most of the media has been deferential to the mayor and his allies, and it's been extremely curious to me why the role of independent media is to go after stories like this, hold the powerful accountable, not presume guilt, but to thoroughly investigate. And to investigate the investigators who may or may not have conflicts of interest. I don't see that happening except in the past week at the San Francisco Examiner, which is a very small, scrappy organization, to say the least. But they have been far and away the most conscientious, and they broke the story, and they've been following it every day. Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, Jonah Owen Lamb, and their colleagues.
It's times like these when you miss the San Francisco Bay Guardian. I had to wonder how they would cover this.
Oh, absolutely.
They shut down earlier this year.
Yeah. Well, the irony is that the company that owns the Examiner and the Weekly was the one that acquired the Bay Guardian and then unceremoniously shuttered it, leaving the community much poorer.
And just quickly, the details in this story are right out of a movie. So why don't you think it's getting better coverage in other media outlets?
I don't know. I mean, that's open to interpretation. There is so much nuance and complication to this, and it's very difficult to do investigative reporting about the FBI, about prosecutions of corruption, and the media has been so hollowed out in terms of reductions of staff that investigative reporting is not what it used to be, and we really need to be concentrating on the important stories.
And it says so much about local media, especially in a town and city like San Francisco that has so much influence. I'm glad you brought this up because we're hopefully going to cover this on next Friday's Media Roundtable. Thank you. That is Michael Stoll. He's executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit news organization that publishes a website and an amazing quarterly newspaper. And what about you, Jonathan Thompson, senior editor with High Country News? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to have to give kudos to my local rat here in Durango, the Durango Herald, for the way that they've covered this mine spill. They, you know, like all newspapers, they're kind of a beleaguered breed. They've had to make a lot of cuts, and they've certainly done a lot more sort of soft and cushy journalism in the last few years. But once this tragedy struck, they threw a bunch of resources at it, and they've really dug and tried to get to the root of things. And, you know, I'm pretty impressed.
And so what impressed you about it specifically?
Well, I think, you know, the fact that they were on it very quickly. They saw a good story when they knew a good story when they saw it. They put all their resources into it. And they've kind of badgered the EPA. They've badgered the they've looked into some of the backgrounds of these mines and try to see who owns them and who might be ultimately responsible for that. And that's not very easy to do. And they've done it all on a very tight schedule, you know, deadlines, and with probably not the resources that they should have. And so, yeah, I think that's been pretty impressive for a small town paper. Actually.
So kudos to the Durango Herald, and then also kudos to the San Francisco Examiner, and we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. So let's jump in, Jonathan, and talk about what happened in Colorado. It's been 9 days since this massive toxic mine spill released 3 million gallons of toxic slush into the Animas River. The water contained very high levels of lead, arsenic, mercury, cadmium. Yesterday, the governor drank a bottle of water from the river, adding iodine tablets to let people know that there's nothing to worry about. But the Navajo Nation has declared a state of emergency. And then this morning on NPR, someone who works for a river rafting company was on saying that, very sadly, the small businesses in the area are really being hit hard because obviously everybody canceled their trips. But he's saying that it's starting to clean pretty quickly. He's now seeing the beautiful green-blue water reappear. Can you give us an update on the cleanup efforts?
Yeah, actually, so the plume, you know, really here in Durango, which we're 60 miles downstream from where the spill actually occurred, and the plume has moved through here. It's pretty much done. The water quality has, tests have shown that the water quality is back to pre-spill levels pretty much, with one exception, and that is that sludge, that tangy orange sludge that was going down the river, some of it did settle out into the bottom of the river, so that's still there and could get kicked up if there's a rainstorm or something. It could kick that up and contaminate the water a little bit again. But we things are looking good, and here these small businesses, as you said, are really hoping that they'll reopen the river soon to use because it's still closed. And that's a really big blow to the local tourist industry because rafting down the river is a big part of that, or just playing in the river.
Right. The guy that was on NPR this morning said he takes out about 200 people a day, and they've all canceled their trips.
Yeah, I mean, so those people, because the river's closed, they just can't have the trips. So they had to cancel. Yeah, so they had to cancel everything, and so rafting is part of it. And then there's also a lot of companies that rent out equipment for people to play in the river, and that's done too. So I heard one estimate that one of the bigger companies could lose between $150,000 to $200,000 during this spill, depending on how long that the closure remains. And that's not money you can make up, you know, later on in the season, because the river, there's only so many days that you can actually raft the river. So it's going to be a huge blow. And it's especially heartbreaking because this year we actually had a really wet spring.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah, so the river was looking great. I mean, it was, we had good flows in it. It was it was nice and clean because of those good flows, and there were tons of people on it. And then this.
And it's surreal to see kayakers in this yellow gold sludge. What about the environment? How's the environment affected? Because the toxic water has spread from Colorado to New Mexico to Utah, affecting about 100 river miles. Some worry that it could reach California through the Colorado River. And what about cleanup? You write about competing interests on how to clean up the mines. But first, just talk about the water. What happens when so much toxic water flows through a river going through three states?
Well, you know, that's a good question. For the short term, it looks like the impact was somewhat negligible. One of the things that local wildlife officials did is they put fish in cages in the river before the plume arrived, and, you know, just little fingerling trout, and they let them stay in there for 5 days as the plume moved through, and only one out of 108 fish died, which is considered normal. So the short-term impacts, it looks like, you know, it's pretty good besides the way it looked and that sort of thing. Long-term, we still don't really know yet how those fish may fare or not fare in the future. And we also don't really know what impact that sludge as it settles down into the riverbed, but what that might do to bugs and that sort of thing. And it really, the contamination is still kind of moving downstream in Utah and parts of the Navajo Nation, so it's probably still too early to kind of tell what's happening there. Optimistically, it looks like a lot of it's settling out as it goes and being diluted and that sort of thing, so that by the time it reaches Lake Powell, hopefully it will be dissipated enough that its impacts will be minimal, but it's not clear yet.
Yeah, let's hope. So there are two other angles here, and Michael, I'd love you to jump in. We'll talk about rules to protect rivers, so that's another angle the media can take. The other angle I mentioned in the lead-in, in a CNN op-ed, Earthworks Policy Director Lauren Pagel writes that what's really missing from the coverage is the fact that about 500,000 mines, according to Earthworks, in the U.S. need to be cleaned up with a price tag of $50 billion. And she says that's the bigger story here. What are your thoughts on that, Michael?
I think it's there is a long-term low-grade scandal in environmental policy across the country, in that the Superfund program has been systematically starved. And there are dozens, or I think even hundreds, of cleanup sites around the country. Defunct companies abandon their spills of chemicals or mines or other toxic problems, and it's given over to the federal or local governments to clean up. And so that's a huge liability on the part of the public. And without sufficient investment, these problems persist, and you have more chance of the pollution getting worse underground, in rivers, in the air.
And Jonathan, you wrote about this. You write about the competing interest on how to clean up these mines. Environmentalists are raising questions about the lack of strong regulatory policies to deal with these kinds of disasters. What did you learn in your reporting?
Yeah, that's correct. One of the things to understand about this spill is that really what it was water that would have drained out of the mine anyway, and it just got dammed up, and then it came bursting out all at once. But if it didn't come bursting out all at once, it would have continued to run into the streams, acidic, heavy metal loaded stuff over a long period of time. And that's because there's all these mines that really, in a lot of cases, in most cases, they were abandoned years and years ago. And so there's no company left to clean them up. So what that means is that we rely on federal agencies, on volunteers, on Good Samaritans, and potentially on the EPA to come in there and clean these things up. So early on, when the magnitude of the problem here was understood, the EPA tried to come in and do Superfund, but the locals really pushed back because of the potential stigma and how that might impact tourism. And so so the Superfund did not happen, and instead they took sort of a stakeholders approach to cleaning up these mines, and a piecemeal approach, I would say. That succeeded to some extent, but then it started falling apart again, and more recently efforts to do Superfund have come back. But again, there's been resistance, and nothing's really happened. So in this case, I think that a lot of people, now that this did happen, there's going to be a lot of pressure to go ahead and designate it as a Superfund site, hopefully, which will bring in a lot of resources to clean this up in a comprehensive way. The problem is, as Michael said, that Superfund itself is lacking in resources. So we'll see.
I find that so ironic, because the response from some politicians, especially those who are running for president right now, is exactly the opposite, that EPA that this demonstrates that the EPA is quote-unquote incompetent, that the directors should be fired. I'm talking about Donald Trump and Marco Rubio. Both came out in The Hill in an article today, saying that that essentially the responsibility for all cleanups should be devolved to local governments, and so it would seem from what you're saying that that would only make things worse.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it were to local governments to do it, just imagine what that would look like on a long river like this. Which local governments are gonna, if it was the ones at the headwaters. The nearest one, Silverton, is a town of about 400, 500 people. They certainly don't have the resources to do it. Then, so, you know, it's just a river is, of course, a much bigger thing than a local problem. So to clean it up, yeah, I think that it's a federal problem, and it should be dealt with on a higher level.
And Jonathan, in May, the EPA came out with new rules to protect rivers, but the rules were attacked by fertilizer companies, the agriculture sector, energy producers, and Republicans. They say these new rules violate state laws. President Obama assured various interest groups that the law would be getting in the way of farming, ranching, or forestry, and eventually, at the end of the day, agriculture was left out. So now 16 states, including Colorado, is suing the federal government to block these laws. Is this getting much attention in Colorado?
It's not getting as much attention as it probably should be, no, you know, because that is a big deal. And that's especially a big deal. Those rules impact Western waterways the most, because they have to do with arroyos and sort of dry washes that are not year-round streams. And so there's not enough attention on it.
That is Jonathan Thompson. He is senior editor of High Country News. This is a biweekly newspaper that reports on the West's natural resources, public lands, and changing communities. We are also joined by Michael Stoll, executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit news organization that publishes a website and a quarterly newspaper. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have, or what was your reaction when you heard about the toxic water spill in Colorado? It's been getting so much attention. And what questions do you have about it? What about the other angles, like the river laws, for example, mining cleanup. Are you seeing much reporting on that? And then we're going to talk about the San Francisco Public Press investigation about the $21 billion tech-driven building boom in flood-prone areas near Bay Area shorelines. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are your thoughts on media coverage of these issues? And then if there was something else that caught your attention in the media this week, we'd love to hear from you. Jonathan, Chris and Marin called in, but he couldn't stay on the line. He wanted to ask you about an op-ed in the Silverton Standard recently by former geologist Dave Taylor. He predicted the spill a week before it happened, but he said no one listened. Did you see this article, and is anyone talking about this?
I did see that article, and there are people talking about it. Personally, I don't put much credence in what was said in the article. If you look at it, the details are kind of off compared to what actually happened. His argument was that the EPA did this on purpose in order to drum up support for Superfund and to get rid of mining in the region. But mining is already out of the region, and I just can't give that much credence, I'm afraid.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And then going back to the mines, especially abandoned mines, the AP reports that until the late 1970s, there were no regulations on mining in most of the region, meaning anyone could dig a hole where they liked and searched for things like gold, silver, or zinc. And then abandoned mines fill up with groundwater and snowmelt that becomes tainted with acids and heavy metals from mining veins, which can trickle into the region's waterways. Experts estimate there are 55,000 abandoned mines from Colorado to Idaho to California. So again, Michael, it seems like this goes back to the importance of local reporting on these issues.
Yeah, I just on that point, about 15 years ago when I was doing environmental reporting for The Examiner, I did a story about abandoned mines in the Sierra, and environmental officials were really concerned that very far upstream gold mines that had been abandoned were getting very high levels of mercury contamination, and then those were very slowly trickling out into the waterways and then down into San Francisco Bay. And there is a layer of mercury at the bottom of San Francisco Bay that has not been remediated beyond the natural flow of all of the rivers, slowly pushing it out molecule by molecule. It's going to take decades for most of that contamination to clear up. So this is the legacy that we're living with.
Right. And then how does that contamination affect wildlife?
I don't know what the level of scientific research on that is, certainly the bay ecology has changed dramatically.
And Jonathan, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
I'm looking at a lot of some of the background, more of the background on this problem here, and some of going back way beyond before the spill, and looking at what I call the slow motion spill, which is exactly what Michael was just talking about, this water trickling out and these metals going into the water stream every day, and in many cases killing fish. Mm. Here we see the impacts all the time on trout.
Well, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your reporting, and we will look for that piece. Jonathan Thompson is senior editor of High Country News, a newspaper that reports on the West's natural resources, public lands, and changing communities. Thanks for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Listening to Your Call on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Again, it's a toll-free call. If you prefer to write rather than use the telephone, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. And then at noon today, it's the Tavis Smiley Show.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will kick off a week-long series about the prison system in the United States. How did the U.S. become the world's leading prison nation? From 1970 to 2010, the number of people in state and federal prisons went from 200,000 to more than 1.6 million. That happened in 40 years. So that is on Monday. And then on Tuesday, we're going to talk about the business of prisons and prison unions. On Wednesday, we will talk about long-term impacts of children. How are children and teens who have spent time in prison affected by that experience? Thursday, we will talk about successful reform initiatives. And then Friday, we'll talk about media coverage of prisons. We hope you can join us next week. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And Michael Stoll is in studio. He's executive director of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit, non-commercial organization that publishes a website and really great quarterly newspaper. It's beautiful. Michael just brought in the latest issue, and I hope you can pick it up. So, Michael, you and your colleagues have an amazing investigation called, well, the lead piece is Major San Francisco Bayfront Developments Advance Despite Sea Rise Warnings. You report that builders plan to invest more than $21 billion in offices and homes in flood-prone areas where waters could climb 8 feet above today's high tide by the end of the century. Land use records reveal that the building boom, fueled by a white hot tech economy, is moving too fast for regulators to keep pace. So first off, how did you even come up with the idea of this story?
Well, there has been some great reporting about sea level rise over the last 10 years or so from environmental reporters at the San Jose Mercury News, Bay Area News Group in general, San Francisco Chronicle, and other publications. It has been very focused on individual reports from government agencies and nonprofit organizations. Every time they issue a new map or a new report about sea level rise, it gets covered as a one-day story. Reading between the lines, you get a picture from all of this coverage that there's something bigger going on. And what the bigger thing that's going on is that there is a danger zone around the inside of San Francisco Bay that scientists have been telling us for over a decade that the sea is going to rise several feet over the next few decades. And what are we doing to prepare for it? And so that was the point of departure. And the other thing that makes it newsworthy right now is the incredibly fast growth in real estate development on what was previously marginal land on the edge of the bay is really making this an urgent problem for policymakers.
Okay, and so when we talk about sea rise, it's almost kind of difficult to visualize what that would look like in San Francisco. But talk about first the causes of this. We've got climate change, and then the Arctic is melting. And I saw a documentary recently, Chasing the Ice. Highly recommend it. It's so well done because it looks at how glaciers are shrinking rapidly. And so you have these massive chunks of ice that are breaking and falling into the water, which is causing the water to rise. I mean, that's a very simplistic way to explain it, but that's what's happening right now. And we're not spending that much time talking about it.
Well, Antarctica and Greenland are very far away. It's impossible, even just, you know, looking at documentaries about icebergs calving into the ocean, it's impossible to get a sense of scale without putting, say, the Empire State Building next to it. Those ice caps are what are preventing the Earth from experiencing a rise in sea level of more than 200 feet. And if we continue on our pace of pollution, we are going to see that in the next few centuries if the rise in carbon dioxide pollution and methane pollution increases faster than it has been, it could be a much shorter period of time.
You report that even the scenario widely considered most likely, 3 feet of permanent rise would put thousands of acres of the current shoreline underwater.
And that's by the year 2100.
2100. Okay, so talk a little bit about the process involved in this reporting, because you've got many in-depth pieces. Who do you decide to talk to first when you start a piece like this?
Well, there are many climate scientists and local planners people working for independent organizations, and also independent watchdogs like the civil grand juries in San Francisco and San Mateo counties that have looked at some of the implications of the current building boom on the shoreline, and really see a conflict there. So much of the policy has been set city by city, county by county, and sometimes one creek at a time, or one property line at a time. The problem is that sea level rise will affect the entire bay, and in fact, all coastlines around the world. And it doesn't discriminate, based on the property lines. It is a regional problem. It is a national problem. And at the very least, we should have a regional solution. There is no regional solution. There are at least a dozen different agencies that are trying to coordinate, trying to set best practices, but it's really in the early stages.
So you report that a few local governments, including Mountain View, are beginning to spend money on sea level rise infrastructure projects that might protect waterfront business districts. San Francisco is in its second year of planning to address sea rise, but the city has yet to update its floodplain ordinance or planning and building codes to address increasing flood risks on the waterfront. This is at a time when massive projects are planned on the waterfront. We've got the Warriors Stadium. The Giants are building these new condos. You report that Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, and Microsoft are among the marquee corporate names driving the bayfront explosion. So how can this happen if these massive companies and entities are building on the waterfront and that planning and building codes have yet to address this?
I think there's fundamentally a mismatch in a number of respects between the planning departments of local governments and the interests of the corporations that are driving development. The tech industry is building a lot of office space as fast as it can in Silicon Valley, because they need office space now because they're experiencing a lot of growth, which is great for the local economy. It's great for jobs. It's great for local taxes. The time horizons of these companies are much, much shorter. They budget on a quarterly basis. They budget on a yearly basis. Some of them have only been around for 10 or 15 years. They can't imagine the 85 years we have left until 2100, when some of these predictions are coming true. I just wanted to point out that 85 years is within a human lifetime. Kids who are born right now are going to experience sea levels that are possibly 3 feet higher, possibly much more.
I'm speaking today with Michael Stoll, executive editor of San Francisco Public Press. This is a nonprofit, non-commercial news organization that publishes a website and an amazing quarterly newspaper. And you can find it at your local bookstore, independent stores. You can also read this investigation, although it's better to read it in the newspaper because there are amazing graphics. You can also read it online and find a link at yourcallradio.org. So what questions do you have about coverage of these issues? So here we are in the Bay Area. In San Francisco, massive building boom, massive inequality, and then we're going to have sea rise, big sea rise in the next 80 years. Okay, so again, talk about what climate scientists told you. What can we expect in the next 40 to 80 years?
Well, I think a lot of the problem with coverage of sea level rise has been it's too complicated for most people to understand over breakfast.
Right.
One very simple problem that journalists can resolve is whether they're going to measure sea level rise in centimeters, inches, feet, or meters, or something else. The conversion between metric and English measurements is a big problem in basic understanding of the scale of the problem. And so we made a decision just to boil everything down to feet. the number we came up with was 8 feet of sea level rise by the year 2100, and that is the outside of a consensus of over a dozen different computer models that add up 4.6 feet of basic sea level rise with the anticipated additional storm surge in a rare but very possible storm, a 100-year storm. So it would be more than 4 feet on any given day at mean high tide. Above that is what could happen in an emergency situation, not unlike what happened in Hurricane Sandy or Katrina. And the question is, do we want a precautionary approach, or do we want Ed Lee and the Board of Supervisors and a lot of local governments are calling a pragmatic approach that accepts a certain amount of risk.
We're talking about San Francisco Public Press Investigation. Major San Francisco Bayfront developments and developments across the Bay Area are advancing despite sea rise warnings. And if you have any questions about this, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about coverage of these issues? There's a lot of coverage about what's going on in the Bay Area, extremely high rents, so much new development. But are you reading anything about what's to come in 20, 30 years, 40 years? Who's going to foot the bill when we have sea level and it affects these businesses and these buildings? Right now, this is kind of amazing. Oh, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I mentioned Google, Microsoft, LinkedIn, and Facebook, as you report, are the marquee corporations driving the Bayfront explosion. And cities are courting companies to build near sea level, often on landfill created in the mid-20th century in former salt marshes. And much of that land could return to the sea unless these cities erect seawalls, levees, and other massive edifices.
I just wanted to go back and correct one thing I said for
sure.
The record. It's actually the outside mean sea level rise, mean high tide sea level rise is 6.4 feet with storm surge on top of that for a total of 8 feet. And that's what we mapped. The only thing that we did differently from what other news organizations did was we mapped that 8-foot level and then found all of the properties within that where there have been public announcements in the San Francisco Business Times, in the Chronicle, and in planning records in San Francisco, showing where new developments are happening right now and are getting permitted or currently under construction. So that's the context. And what we did was relatively simple. It was just a mapping exercise, and we just added up the number of acres. It's 5,400 acres total, and then we added up the number of all of the numbers that we could find, all of the development costs that were previously published or in the planning records. $21 billion is a very conservative estimate. It's probably going to be closer to $100 million or more, based on the land value, based on the total build-out value, and the expected resale value of condominiums and offices. So there is an amazing amount of money going into this. I think the one of the problems that we uncovered is that there is a total lack of a consensus or understanding in local planning departments about their both about the science and about their responsibility to be precautious, to take precautions. Much of the way that environmental planning and permitting works is that the companies themselves are required to produce reports that become environmental impact reports that they need to get passed before they can build, and they are required to produce what is called the best available science. Oftentimes, what they do is they say, well, for this particular creek, for some time, let's say 2067, there's going to be 1.5 feet of sea level rise in this area, and disregard storm surge. In other words, they're very carefully picking and choosing their numbers to to demonstrate that their particular plan or their particular property will not be at risk.
You report that the Golden State Warriors, this is a contentious issue, it's a $1 billion plan for a mixed-use facility in the Mission Bay neighborhood south of downtown, and the basketball team's engineers admit in an application for environmental review that the site could, under some scenarios, temporarily flood to depths between 2 and 4 feet by the year 2100. So what do city planners do when they get this information?
Well, you know, San Francisco used to really not care anything about this. There has been a marked and rapid change, particularly in the city, you know, and to the credit of this administration and to the departments in the city, it's moving faster than it ever has before. And this, they're in their second year of planning. There's a citywide committee with many different agencies trying to come up with what are consensus scientific measurements and recommendations. It's very complicated, but I think San Francisco is in the lead of proposing standards, which actually should be the responsibility of some of these regional agencies, but San Francisco has taken the lead, especially the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. And hopefully, the idea is that over the course of the fall and over next year, some of these recommendations that currently just apply to public property like the sewer and the seawalls on the Embarcadero will be applied to private property, which is the vast majority of the investment.
We talked about private property. Also, San Francisco Public Press reports that projects now in the pipeline in San Francisco would add 25,000 new apartments. On Treasure Island alone, developers are ready to break ground on a forest of residential towers that could house 12,000 people. So 25,000 new apartments in San Francisco, 12,000 people on Treasure Island alone. Michael Stoll is executive director of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit, and their cover story is about all of these new developments advancing despite sea rise warnings. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. The email is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ron in Salinas. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for addressing this issue. I just had a quick question. You know, we talk about 2100. What's going to happen in the next 30, 40 years, so in my lifetime? And the second part of that question is the sea level rise going to be uniform all across the globe? Is it going to hit certain parts of the world, certain areas of North America versus other areas? I'll take my question at the air.
Yeah, all the scientists we talked to and all of the available reports, and I should point out that many of the reports are converging on a set of predictions that while there is much uncertainty, and that's the, you know, that's the difference between 6.4 feet and 3 feet by the year 2100, the range has narrowed quite a bit. All of the general trend is every time that there's a major study that takes into account more data and uses these complex computer models, the trend is that each time the level rises higher. There's also, if you look at the graphs, and we have some in the paper, the expectation among all the scientists is that it's going to accelerate as the effects of climate change, both in the Antarctic and Greenland, but also the thermal expansion of the oceans, which is a big part of it, it's going to increase at an ever faster rate, and that. Increases the importance of early planning, and so there's a sense, and we talked to an environmental planning professor, Christina Hill at UC Berkeley, who said, you know, we have a very narrow window of time to address this problem, and then we're living in the last few decades of stable sea levels, and so if we're, you know, there are billions of dollars of development now. You take Foster City, for example. It's just basically a network of canals. You know, that's sunk cost. That's existing vulnerability to sea level rise that we're going to have to engineer our way out of one way or another, whether we're going to build dikes or dams or marshes or we're going to unbuild the city and move everybody inland. You know, those are choices that future generations are going to have to make. But meanwhile, we're actually building right now at below or just slightly above sea level. And the question is, what should we do about it? Should we be doing it at all? Should we be changing the way we build? Should we be coming up with new architectural models that allow occasional flooding? Should we be elevating the first floors of buildings to anticipate what is possible?
And who's going to pay for this when this all happens? Ron, thank you for the question. Your question about how it's going to happen, what's going to happen around the globe, we will add that to our show list because I think that would be a really good show. I mean, people in the South Pacific are already dealing with this right now. And according to Scientific American, without climate change action, scientists believe that at this rate, all of the year-round ice in the Arctic could be gone as early as 2030. Again, I highly recommend this documentary, Chasing Ice, because it explains what's going on right now and how it's also affecting us here.
Yeah. I mean, all the scientists are saying, well, basic physics will tell you that disappearance of ice in the Arctic that's floating on the water is not going to change sea level. It's basically just like an ice cube melting on water, and the total sea level will remain the same. It's really the ice caps. It's really the glaciers in Antarctica, in Greenland, that's the vast majority of the melt.
Right.
And you can't put that ice back once it melts. It takes thousands of years for that to build up, assuming that we get back down to the historical levels of somewhere like 300 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which we've vastly exceeded.
Right. And they're shrinking so quickly. And you'll see that shrink in this documentary, Chasing Ice. Let's go to Jerry calling from Cupertino. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
Good. I have a real quick question. You mentioned the fact that Yahoo and Google and I'm not sure LinkedIn are close to the bay, and those will obviously be affected. But it turns out these high tech companies really don't have a whole lot of. I mean, there's no data centers there. The data centers are, you know, they're spread around the world. But I don't think Google has a major data center in the Bay Area. So it's basically people. And do we have any idea of what these companies are planning in 10 years out to say, well, you know, this place is going to flood out. It's going to cost us a couple of $1 billion or more to attempt to maintain our current facilities. So we're just going to relocate. You know, they could basically pick up and move to some other state or some other area and leave the Bay Area with considerably less income and tax revenue and the like. You know, it's hard to fool Mother Nature. Building dikes and building levees or whatever against the ocean is not necessarily the easiest or most complete way of dealing with climate change.
Well, that's a whole bunch of questions wrapped up into one. I should say Yahoo wasn't on the list. Facebook is. Google is a really interesting case because they applied for the vast majority of this underused plot of land right on the bay, the North Bay Shore development in Mountain View. And they were actually denied it, and most of it was given over to LinkedIn. And there was some real fear in Mountain View that Google was taking up too much real estate. They're gobbling up. You know, they've bought part of Moffett Field, a place across the street from Moffett Field, and now the North Bay Shore development. They had some really sort of fanciful architectural renderings of this undulating glass dome that they were saying had all of these environmental attributes to it. And Mountain View said, well, we don't want to put all of our eggs in one corporate basket. We want some diversity of tax revenue, just because of what you said, that they want to make sure that if one company decides to contract, It's not going to deprive the whole city of tax revenue. But I think you're absolutely right that the companies are thinking on much shorter time horizons. I mean, some of these companies are only 10 or 15 years old. They can't imagine they almost certainly will not own these properties 85 years from now if they exist at all.
Well, and so who's going to pay for this? Because these seawalls, these levees that we're going to need, who pays for that?
A lot of people have a lot of different ideas. And so one of the interesting things that we found was the Port of San Francisco has a plan sitting on a shelf for over $2 billion basically dike all around the finger piers of San Francisco that would hold back the sea and protect existing downtown and waterfront infrastructure. You know, the engineers are very, very confident that they can build whatever structures they need to keep the sea out. You see some successful examples of that, like in the Netherlands, where they have huge seawalls that go for miles that are really preventing disaster on a daily basis. But then on the other hand, you see what the Army Corps of Engineers was responsible for in New Orleans. And, you know, a levee works until it doesn't.
So taxpayers?
Will be on the hook unless there are new ways that we come up with to pay for these things. There's interesting things like tax incentives and special tax districts that they're using on Treasure Island.
And I also want to point out, this is important, you report that San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee and the Board of Supervisors last year resisted a call from the chair of the city's civil grand jury to stop approving new shoreline development until stricter building rules are passed.
Yeah, and that was the opinion of one of the people on the civil grand jury. The report itself didn't call for that, but it's an indication that there is some conflict there.
Ed Lee meets with tech execs almost every week. Are they talking about this? Just quickly.
You'd have to ask Ed Lee and the tech execs.
Michael Stoll is executive director and editor of the San Francisco Public Press, a local nonprofit. I hope you can check out their investigative piece, Major Bayfront Developments Advance Despite Sea Rise Warnings. Michael, thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How did the United States become the world's leading prison nation? On the next Your Call, we'll kick off a week-long series about the prison industrial complex. From 1970 to 2010, the number of people in state and federal prisons went from 200,000 to more than 1.6 million. So how did we become the world's leading prison nation? And are we at a turning point for prison policy in the U.S.? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihei Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online, kalw.org. Coming up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC. The program was recorded earlier this morning for broadcast at this time. Following that at 12 noon, it's the Tavis Smiley Show, and then this afternoon at 1, Latino USA. It is 11 o'clock, and this is 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, Local Public Radio.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. And today, this is where our conversation begins.
I'm one of two interns who are from Africa, and so I know many people from my university who would have loved this opportunity but could probably not afford to do it.
Should all interns be paid? A 22-year-old from New Zealand sparked the conversation after claiming he could only afford to live in a tent during his internship at the UN in Geneva. It's been exposed as a publicity stunt, but hasn't stopped the conversation. On Facebook, many of you say your internships were hugely beneficial, but what about the argument it's only open to rich kids? Plus, South African schools are allowing pupils to choose to learn Mandarin from next year. Critics say it's colonialism. And is it okay for Hollywood films to rewrite history?